This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Wonders of the World, Trials of the Soul, and Revelations of the Spirit. This is Lecture 3. In this course of lectures, I hope to give a general outline of some most important truths relating to spiritual science as seen from a certain point of view. The arrangement of the subject we are following will perhaps only come out clearly in later lectures, as a wide range of problems must be dealt with, which can only be grouped into a whole at the end. I have made many allusions to the mystery of Eleusis and to Greek mythology, and I shall often have occasion to refer to our dramatic performances. But when we come to the end, you will see that I had another purpose in view in the present cycle of lectures. I should like tonight to call up in you a certain understanding of the way in which spiritual science or anthroposophy works toward that mighty cosmic wisdom, of which we have caught a glimpse in those great forms and images, and in those relics of the mysteries which come to us from ancient Greece. If we would understand the full import of the present task and mission of anthroposophy, we must familiarize ourselves with the thought that many an opinion and many a conception prevailing at the present day must be changed. In this respect, the modern man is indeed often very short-sighted. He hardly looks beyond the immediate future. Precisely on these grounds, and in order to awaken a feeling of the necessity of changing our own ideas and thoughts, if we are to have a really deep insight into the mission of anthroposophy, a light has been thrown on the totally different nature of the Greek conception of the world, of life, and of man's relationship to the spiritual worlds from our own. Very different indeed were the feelings of heart and soul among the Greeks from those of modern man. But before going any further, there is something which I should like to mention. There is a certain conception extremely well known to you all, an idea which is not only to be found in the vocabulary of all languages, but has found its way into the terminology of a certain school of scientific thought. It is the word nature. When that word is uttered, immediately a host of conceptions arises before the soul, representing things which we designate today by the name of nature, and we look on nature as something outside the soul or mind. Now nothing at all that we refer to when we use the term nature, nothing at all of this, existed for the old Greek. We must completely obliterate the memory of everything to which we now give the name of nature, if we would penetrate into the thought of ancient Greece. That contrast between nature and spirit, that duality which we feel today, was unknown to the Greek of ancient times. When he directed his gaze to external processes, even such as we observe in the woods and fields, in sun and moon, and or in the starry firmament, he did not feel in these merely the life of nature devoid of spirit. On the contrary, everything that took place in the universe was to the Greek as much the deed of spiritual beings as the movement of the hand is to us the expression of an activity of the soul. When we move our hand from left to right, we know that the movement is caused by an impulse of the soul, and we do not dream of an opposition between the movement of our hand and our will. We know that the impulse of will, which causes the movement, and the movement of the hand itself, are one. We can still feel this unity when we make a gesture which is an expression of the soul. But when we consider the course of the sun and moon, or watch the clouds in motion, or perceive the movement of the air in wind, we no longer regard these, as did the ancient Greek, as the gestures of divinely spiritual beings, similar to the movement of a hand. But we regard these processes of nature as something external, abstract, and as subject to purely mathematical and mechanical laws, and not as the outward gesture of divinely spiritual activities, as was known to the ancient Greek. We shall now hear how the modern conception of nature first arose. Spirit and nature were, as we have seen in those ancient times, in perfect harmony. Hence what is known as a wonder or a miracle at the present day awakened in the old Greek an entirely different set of feelings. Leaving out of consideration all finer shades of difference, we might say that what we call a miracle at the present day is an event perceived in the outer world, inexplicable by the laws of nature already known, or by others akin to them, but which presupposes an intervention of spiritual forces. In a case in which a man perceives something purely spiritual, which he cannot understand or explain by the merely physical laws of mathematics and mechanics, he would assume that it was something miraculous. In such a case, the old Greek would not have thought of a miracle, for he knew that everything that happens in nature is the work of the Spirit, whether it was a matter of the ordinary events of daily occurrence or not. This made no difference, except that the one was of rare occurrence, and the other an everyday occurrence, or everyday experience. But in his eyes, the divinely spiritual creative power and action intervened in all the workings of nature. From this we may see how these conceptions have changed. For it is essentially a feature of our present life that the intervention of spiritual forces in the ordinary happenings of the physical plane must be regarded as something miraculous, as an exception to the ordinary course of events. It is peculiar to our modern life of feeling to draw a sharp line of demarcation between what we believe to be governed by natural law and what we must recognize as a direct intervention of the spiritual worlds. I have spoken to you of the mingling of two streams of force, the one that of Demeter and Persephone, and the other that of Agamemnon and Iphigenia. In the mission of spiritual science, it is the mission of spiritual science to unite these two streams. In connection with this union, we should speak of the necessity for man to regain the feeling that in every occurrence of ordinary life, as well as in rarer events, the Spirit is everywhere active. Before he can acquire again these feelings, however, the man of today must clearly represent to himself that there are two currents. He must distinctly understand that there exist, on the one hand, those things which take their place in a natural system governed by laws recognized at the present day by the physical scientist, the chemist, the physiologist, and the biologist. On the other hand, there are occurrences that can be followed up like any other facts, which are also subject to the physical, mathematical, and chemical laws, but which are inexplicable unless we assume that there is spiritual life and activity behind the physical plane. The conflict stirred up in the human soul by this division, and simultaneously the longing to reconcile the two opposites, nature and spirit, we see surging within the soul of Strader in the Rosicrucian drama. We see in the character of Strader and in the trials through which his soul passes, as depicted in the mystery drama, The Portal of Initiation, how an event constituting a departure from the ordinary course of nature, such as the vision of Theodora, affects one accustomed to recognize as real only such phenomena as can be explained by physical and chemical laws, and how an event of this nature acts upon such a temperament like an ordeal of the soul. In this episode we have crystallized, as it were, something which finds expression in many modern souls, and which is the outcome of this opposition. Souls like Strader are very common in our day. For them, a clear insight into all that is peculiar to the regular, normal course of natural facts, as explainable by physical, chemical, and biological laws, is a necessity. On the other hand, it is equally necessary that such souls should be led to recognize those facts, which, while they also appear on the physical plane, are yet regarded by the purely materialistic thinker as miracles, and are therefore simply put aside as an impossibility, and passed by without recognition. Thus we may say that a longing prevails at the present day to bridge over this opposition between nature and spirit, which did not exist as yet in ancient Greece. That attempts are made and societies founded to trace the working and the nature of laws other than the purely chemical, physical, and biological of the physical world is proof that a yearning exists in the widest circles to bridge over this opposition. The union and harmonizing of the differences between spirit and nature lies within the scope and activities of our spiritual science. The starting point of our work must be the new sources of knowledge opened up to us by spiritual science. We must regain the possibility of seeing more in all that surrounds us than the eye of the physicist or chemist, the anatomist, physiologist, or biologist can see. To this end, we must start from man himself, who demands of us so imperatively that we should study not only the chemical and physical laws working in his physical body, but that we should seek to discover the cooperation of physical, psychical, and spiritual laws. This cooperation may indeed be evident, if but in an inconspicuous way, to physical eyes and to everyone who truly desires to see it. Modern man no longer feels what I have so far been able only to hint at, as the working of the Demeter or Persephone forces in the human organism. He is no longer sensible of the fact that we bear within us everything that has been poured forth into the universe. The Greek was conscious of this. He was conscious of a truth, though he could not have expressed it in our modern language, which must by degrees become a part of modern anthroposophy, a truth which I should like to bring home to you in the following manner. We look up at the rainbow. As long as it cannot be explained, it is as much a wonder of nature, a miracle, as anything else. Suddenly, from the commonplace of everyday life, the wonderful bow with its seven colors appears before us. We are now abstaining from all physical explanations of it. The physical science of the future will have a very different explanation to give from that of the present of many things besides the rainbow. As I said, we look up to the sky and behold the rainbow which emerges as from the womb of the surrounding universe. There we gaze into the macrocosm, the great universe. Out of it the rainbow is born. Now let us turn our gaze inward. We may notice as a matter of everyday observation that, for example, when we give ourselves up to vague brooding, certain thoughts relating to something in particular take shape within us. In other words, that thought flashes up within our souls. Take the two following facts, the first that of the macrocosm, and that the rainbow is born from the womb of the universe, and the second, that thought is born within us out of our own soul life. These are two truths which were known to the sages of ancient Greece, and men must relearn them through anthroposophy. The forces which cause thoughts to flash up within our microcosm are the same forces which call forth the rainbow from the womb of the universe. In the same way, as the forces of Demeter enter the human being from without and become active within him, so the same forces working from outside form the rainbow out of the substances of nature. There they work in the realms of space. Here, in the microcosm, or little world of man, causing thought to flash up out of the void. Truths like these have not as yet even been approached by ordinary physical science. Nevertheless, they are undoubted facts. Everything that is outside in space is within ourselves. Man does not yet recognize the perfect harmony between the forces mysteriously working within himself and those working without in the macrocosm. Perhaps he even looks upon this as idle speculation or fantastic dreaming. The ancient Greek could not say what I have just said to you regarding these things, because he could not penetrate them with his intellect. But the knowledge of them lived in his subconscious psychic life. He saw and felt them clairvoyantly. If we try to put this feeling into modern language, we should say, the Greek felt that within his soul the forces worked which gave birth to thought, and that these were the same forces which organized the rainbow without in the cosmos. This was his feeling. He then asked himself the question, if the psychic forces which give birth to thought are within, what is without? What can that spiritual element be, extended in the fields of space above and below, left and right, before and behind? What is it that is spread abroad through all space? The inward forces of the soul, those that cause thoughts to flash up within the soul, those forces which cause the rainbow to shine forth in the heavens, that give rise to the splendor of dawn and sunset, the radiance and light of the clouds, what is it that causes all this? For the ancient Greek, it was a spiritual being who gave birth to all these phenomena out of the universal ether, the rose of dawn and sunset, the rainbow, the shining of the clouds, lightning and thunder. And from this feeling, which did not, as I said, develop into intellectual knowledge, but was an elemental feeling, arose the belief, this is Zeus. We can form no conception of, still less can we experience the feeling aroused in the soul of the ancient Greek by Zeus, unless we try to understand the emotions and feelings of that soul from the point of view of spiritual science. Zeus was a being with an absolutely distinct form, but it is not possible to represent this form to oneself unless one has the feeling that the forces which give rise to thought in us are also active in physical lightning, in the rainbow, etc. We, who are anthroposophists, can say when we consider ourselves as human beings and strive to understand the forces which evoke in us thoughts or conceptions, and all that flashes up in our consciousness, we can say today, all this is comprised within what we call the human astral body. Here we have the microcosmic substance, the astral body. We can now put the question, which we have just suggested, in a symbolic form, in one more, in accordance with spiritual science. We may say, the astral body is the microcosmic within us. What corresponds to the astral body in the outer realms of space? What fills all space, right and left, before and behind, above and below? As the astral body fills our microcosm, so are the realms of space, so is the universal ether, filled with the macrocosmic counterpart of our astral body. And we know that that which the Greek of ancient times represented to himself as Zeus is the macrocosmic counterpart of our astral body. The astral body is in us. It causes the flashing up of the phenomena of consciousness. Outside us is the expanse of astrality, giving birth as from the womb of the universe to the rainbow, the glow of sunset and sunrise, thunder and lightning, clouds, snow, etc. The man of our day has not even a word by which to express what the ancient Greek thought of under the name of Zeus, which is the macrocosmic counterpart of our astral body. We reflect further that beside the flashing up within us of thoughts, conceptions, feelings, which may be momentary or at least of short duration, we have our permanent psychic life with its passions, its impulses, the ebb and flow of its life of feeling which form our character and become a matter of habit and memory. This life of the soul is that by which we distinguish different human characters from one another. Here we see a man with wild passions, impetuously laying hold of everything in his path. We see another contemplating life apathetically. This is different from the momentary thought that rises within us. This constitutes the lasting configuration of our physical life and determines the basis of our good or evil destiny. The man of fiery temperament and strong passions, sympathies and antipathies, may, possibly, under the influence of those waves of feeling, commit an action which causes him happiness or unhappiness. These forces, which are in us all, signify the lasting, deeply seated characteristics which grow into habit and memory. They differ from the forces of the astral body. They are rooted in our etheric or life body. But did we feel like the Greek? But did we feel like the Greek, we should ask now, are there any forces in the universe outside, corresponding to those which influence our habits, passions, and lasting affections? In the Greek, this question would again have been prompted by feeling, without his having exemplified it intellectually, or been clearly conscious of it. He felt in the ebb and flow of the ocean, in the storm, in the hurricane, roaring over the earth, that the same forces were active as in ourselves, when the more enduring impulses and passion, when habits or memories stir within us. Considered microcosmically, these are the soul forces which we include in our conception of the etheric body, and which are the cause of our permanent impulses, emotions, etc. From the macrocosmic standpoint, these are the forces which are closely united to our earth, which, like the Zeus forces, course through space, and give rise to wind and weather, storm and calm, the stillness and the raging of the ocean. In all the phenomena I have just enumerated, in storm, thunder, and lightning, in a turbulent or a tranquil sea, hurricane or calm, in all these the man of today sees only nature, and meteorology as it exists today is a purely external physical science. Such a purely physical science as that of the meteorology of today did not exist in ancient Greece. To the Greeks, a science of this kind would have seemed as foolish as it would seem foolish to us, were we merely to investigate the physical forces that set our muscles in motion when we laugh, and did not know that into these muscular movements the forces of soul substance enter. All these, the atmospheric changes, were gestures of spiritual beings, only they were found in universal space. They represented the same spiritual activity in the macrocosm as is seen in us, the microcosm, as our permanent impulses, passions, and memories. The ancient Greek, who for the most part still retained a consciousness of the form, seen clairvoyantly, of the ruler, the center of these forces in the macrocosm, gave to it the name of Poseidon. I shall now speak further of the physical human body as the densest principle of man. In the physical body of man, we again find in microcosmic form things belonging to a sphere which has not been mentioned in treating of the two other principles of his being. With the astral body is connected everything of the nature of fleeting thoughts and ideas, as they come and go within us. And to the etheric body belong all the habitual, permanent impulses arising in human nature, not merely for thought, living its own separate thought existence in the soul, but for something that is not merely emotion, but which passes into an impulse of will, an impulse to perform some action. For this, during earthly existence, between birth and death, the physical body is necessary. The physical body is that which raises the mere thought or the mere emotion into an impulse of the will, and is the immediate cause of action in the physical world. When we speak of impulses of will, or of the soul forces within us, which underlie impulses of will, we ask, what gives expression to those forces of the soul which are called will? And the answer is found in the whole physiognomy of the physical body. The physical body is the expression of impulses of will, as the astral body is that of mere thoughts, and the etheric body of the more lasting impulses and habits. In order that the will may work through man, here in the physical world, he must have a physical body. In the higher worlds, the activity of will is entirely different from that with which we are familiar in the physical world. Thus we have also within us, microcosmically, the soul forces which bring about progressively the impulses of will necessary to man, so that he may have as the central governing power of his soul an ego suited to him. For without will power, man would never attain the consciousness of his ego. We may now ask, from another standpoint, what were the feelings of the Greek when he asked, "What are the forces spread abroad in the macrocosm that are similar to those which evoke in us impulses of will? What forces are these?" And he is answered with the name of Hades, or Pluto. Hades, the central power outside in macrocosmic space, closely associated with the solid mass of the planet, was to the Greek the macrocosmic counterpart of the impulses of will, which forced Persephone down to the underworld, which was at the same time the underworld of the soul. To anyone gifted with clairvoyant consciousness, and able to behold the spiritual worlds in their reality, self-knowledge is specialized in such a way that he is able to distinguish the triple nature of man in its three aspects, that of the astral, the etheric, and the physical body. It would not have been possible for the ancient Greek to examine the microcosm with the same minute care we apply to it today. As a matter of fact, it was not until the beginning of our fifth post-Atlantean epoch of civilization that the microcosm became the object of close study. The ancient Greek was much more concerned with the forces of Hades, Poseidon, and Zeus in the cosmos, and regarded it as a matter of course that these forces should also be within himself. He lived much more in the macrocosm than in the microcosm. Earlier times are distinguished from later times in that the Greek was more sensible of the macrocosm and all that belonged to it, and peopled the world with the figures of his gods, who were for him the centers of the macrocosmic forces corresponding to them, while the modern man is more concerned with the microcosm, with man himself, as the central point of our world, and is therefore more inclined to seek within his own nature the properties peculiar to the threefold aspect of the world. Thus we become aware of the singular fact that precisely at the beginning of our fifth post-Atlantean period of civilization, there arose in the centers of Western esotericism, showing itself in multifarious ways, the consciousness of the inner activity of the forces of the soul, so that this esoteric wisdom specified the being of man according to the physical, etheric, and astral bodies. Many of the truths given out by scattered individuals of recent times regarding such matters can, now with occult investigation on these lines, is being prosecuted with renewed intensity, receive confirmation. Let me read that again. Many of the truths given out by scattered individuals of recent times regarding such matters can, now that occult investigation on these lines is being prosecuted with renewed intensity, receive confirmation. Thus, in particular, the statements referring to the astral or, in quotes, clear tasting in one's own being, which were first heard of in the 16th and 17th centuries, have lately been fully confirmed. Just as we speak of clairvoyance or of clairaudience, we may also speak of clear or astral tasting. This astral tasting may extend to the threefold nature of the human being. I shall draw an analogy between outer sensations of taste and the various sensations of taste which one may have with regard to one's own threefold being. Call up vividly as possible, the sensation of taste which you experience from an extremely sour fruit, the sloe, for instance, which has an astringent effect in the mouth. Picture to yourselves this sensation heightened, and imagine yourselves inwardly penetrated with this sensation of acidity, of astringency, with an absolutely torturing sensation of contraction. Imagine that you feel yourself from head to foot, through your fingers and every member of your entire organism, permeated by an astringent taste. You would then have that self-knowledge which the occultist is bound to call self-knowledge of the physical body, through the occult or higher sense of taste. When the working of self-knowledge is such that he feels quite permeated by this astringent taste, the occultist knows that he is in the presence of self-knowledge of the physical body. For he knows that the etheric and astral bodies must, if one may so express it, taste differently. As astral and as etheric beings, we perceive taste differently than we do as physical beings. These truths do not fall from the clouds, but are the result of concrete knowledge. They are as widely known among occult scientists as natural laws are among physicists and chemists. And now let us consider that other taste, which is not exactly like that of sugar or sweetmeats. That delicate etheric taste, sense of taste, of which most people are not sensible, but which nevertheless can be experienced in physical life. We experience this sensation when, for example, we find ourselves in an atmosphere of well-being, let us say in an avenue of trees or a wood, where our feelings may find vent in the words, "How I love to be here! I would that my whole being were one with the perfume exhaled from the trees." Imagine this kind of sensation, which may actually be intensified to a kind of sensation of taste, when we lose ourselves in our own inwardness and feel ourselves to be so intensely one with our surroundings that we might taste ourselves in those surroundings. Think of this sensation as transformed into its spiritual aspect, and we find that known to the occultist as clear sapience, when he seeks self-knowledge of the human etheric body. This self-knowledge it is possible to acquire, and it arises when we determine to shut out all consciousness of the physical body and everything connected with impulses of will, to exclude all thought which may flash up within us and give ourselves up entirely to that which constitutes our enduring habits, emotions and passions, our sympathies and antipathies. When the occultist perceives this as a clear taste, when in his character of practical occultist he feels himself in this etheric body of his, then the sensation of clear taste or clear sapience appears in the form which I have just described to you, in relation to the physical world, but spiritualized. We must, therefore, distinguish minutely between the self-knowledge of the physical and that of the etheric body. The astral body can also be recognized in this way by the practical occultist, that is, the occultist who has developed these higher perceptions and feelings. But we can no longer speak of this as a sensation of taste. This sense fails us here, as indeed the physical sense of taste fails with regard to certain substances. We must describe all that belongs to self-knowledge of the astral body differently. It is, however, also possible for the practical occultist to obliterate the consciousness of his physical and etheric bodies, directing his self-knowledge solely to his astral body. That is, he only turns his attention to that part of him which is his astral body. The ordinary man does not do this. When he is conscious of himself, it is the cooperation of his physical, etheric, and astral bodies of which he is aware. He can never blot out the physical and etheric bodies and feel himself in the astral body alone. The ordinary man is unable to be conscious of this because he cannot shut out the physical and etheric bodies. When this takes place in practical occultism, the result is certainly at first an unpleasant sensation, one which can only be compared with the sensation which overtakes the soul in the physical world when there is a want of air and a feeling of suffocation arises. A feeling of anxiety recalling a difficulty in breathing occurs when the etheric and physical bodies are suppressed and self-knowledge is centered upon the astral body. Hence, self-knowledge, relating to the astral body, is at first, in a certain sense, more than any other self-knowledge, accompanied by fear and anxiety, It consists fundamentally in the soul being filled with a feeling of anxiety. One can say it is impossible to perceive the astral body apart from the other principles without a feeling of dread. The reason we do not notice this feeling of dread in ordinary practical life, though it is always present in us, is explained by the fact that the ordinary man, when conscious of himself, perceives a mixture of feelings, a more or less harmonious interplay of the physical, the etheric, and astral bodies, and does not perceive the separate principles by themselves. Now that you have heard what are the fundamental feelings which appear in the soul as self-knowledge, alike of the physical body, representing the forces of Hades, of the etheric body, representing the forces of Poseidon, and of the astral body, representing the forces of Zeus, the questions might suggest themselves to you. How do these separate forces work together? And what is the relationship between the three forces or kinds of force in the physical, etheric, and astral bodies? How can we arrive at some relationship between these forces that can be expressed by a comparison to ordinary things and events in the world? With the greatest ease. Suppose that somebody gave you a receptacle filled with peas, beans, and perhaps some lentils among them. The result would be a mixture. If the quantities of each were unequal, you would have to separate them in order to find their proportion. You might find that the quantity of beans to that of peas and lentils is as 1 to 3 to 5 or otherwise. In short, wherever you have to do with a mixture, you are tempted to examine the proportion among the elements composing it or that are mingled to form it. The question might also arise, how is the strength of the forces in the physical body related to the forces of the etheric body and to those of the astral body? How can we express the measure of strength or weakness belonging to the physical, to the etheric, and to the astral body severally? Is there a formula in numbers or any other means by which we can express the respective relationships of force in the physical, the etheric, and the astral bodies? Regarding this proportion or relationship, I shall speak to you for the first time today. It will give you a deep insight not only into the wonders of the world, but later into the trials of the soul and the revelations of the spirit. It will lead us more and more deeply into our subject. It is possible to express this proportion, and an example can be cited which gives exactly the respective quantities and strengths of our inner forces in physical body, etheric body, and astral body with their corresponding interaction. I shall now sketch the relationship of these for you on the blackboard, for it can only be expressed by a geometrical figure. If we consider deeply this figure on the blackboard, it is one whose whole content gives us the proportions of the magnitude and strength of the forces of our physical, our etheric, and our astral bodies respectively. It is like a part of the occult script on which we can meditate. This sign is the following. As you see, I draw a pentagram. We see in this, in the first place, regarded superficially, a sign for the etheric body. I have already told you that the etheric body is also the center of the forces of the astral and physical bodies, and that from it proceed all the forces which make us young or old. Now, as the center of all these forces lies in the etheric body, it is possible to show by this diagram representing the etheric body what proportion of strength the forces of the physical body bear to the forces of the etheric body and to the forces of the astral body in man. We learn the exact proportions of magnitude when we consider in the first place that here, in the center of the pentagram, we have a five-sided figure pointing downward. I block this in entirely with ink. Here we have one of the figures composing the pentagram. We come to another part of the composite figure of the pentagram when we observe the triangles placed at the five angles of this figure. I fill these triangles in with horizontal lines. Thus I have split up the pentagram for you into a central five-pointed figure pointing downward, filled in with ink, and secondly into five triangles, which I have filled in with horizontal lines. If you measure the size of the five-pointed figure in proportion to the size of the triangles, that is, to the sum of all the planes of the triangles, if you consider how the size of this five-pointed figure compares to that of the separate triangles, you have the proportions of the forces of the physical body to that of the forces of the etheric body in man. I now draw for you a five-sided figure pointing upward, which emerges when I enclose the pentagram and fill it in horizontally. Now we must not only take the triangles of the figure, which show like sharp points, but the entire five-sided figure, including the planes of the pentagram, therefore everything that I have filled in horizontally. So that I beg you to fix your attention on this five-sided figure, filled in horizontally, surrounding the pentagram. As the content of the plane of the small five-sided figure pointing downward is to the plane of this horizontally filled in five-sided figure pointing upward, so is the strength of the forces of the physical body in proportion to the strength of the forces of the human astral body. And as the sum of the horizontally filled in triangles is to the plane of the five-sided figure with the point upwards, so is the strength of the forces of the etheric body in proportion to the strength of the forces of the astral body. In short, in this figure is contained all that may be called the mutual proportions between the forces of the physical body, etheric, and astral body, only all this does not enter man's consciousness. The five-sided figure with the point upward embraces all the astrality in the human being, that also of which the human being as yet knows nothing, but which is perfected by the ego in its gradual work of transformation of the astral body into human spirit, or manas. We also call it spirit self. You may now ask the question, what is the proportion of these three enveloping principles to the ego itself? Well, of the real ego, which I have called the baby, the least developed of all the principles in the human being, of this ego, the normally developed man still knows very little. The sum total of the forces of the ego are, however, already in him. If you consider the totality of the forces of the ego and try to gauge their proportion to those of the physical, the etheric, and the astral bodies, you need only describe a circle round the whole figure. Were I to fill in the whole of this circle as one plane, which would spoil the figure, the size of this plane, in proportion to the size of the plane of the five-sided figure pointing upward, in proportion to the totality of the planes of the triangular tips, which are horizontally filled in proportion to the small five-sided figure pointing downward, filled in with ink, would give the proportion of the forces of the whole ego, represented by the plane of the circle, to the forces of the astral body, represented by the plane of the large five-sided figure, to the forces of the etheric body, represented by the horizontally filled-in triangles adjoining the small five-sided figure, to the forces of the physical body, the plane of the five-sided figure pointing downward filled in with ink. When, in meditation, we give ourselves up to this occult sign and evoke a certain inward feeling of the relationship of these four surfaces to one another, we obtain an impression of the mutual proportions of the physical body, etheric body, and ego. We must therefore think in a similar way of the large circle, concentrating our attention on it in meditation. Then imagine beside it the upward-pointing five-sided figure. This five-sided figure, being smaller, by the amount of the segments of the circle, than the large circle, will make a weaker impression than the circle. In like proportion, as the impression of this five-sided figure is weaker than that obtained from the circle, by so much are the forces of the astral body weaker than the forces of the ego? If in the third place, we picture the five triangles horizontally filled in, without the central five-sided figure, perceiving it all by the same method of illumination, we have again a weaker impression. This impression is weaker than that of the two former, to the same degree as the forces of the etheric body are weaker than those of the astral body and ego. And when we consider this small five-sided figure, picturing it by the same method of illumination as the others, we get the weakest impression of all. Now, if we succeed in creating a feeling of the corresponding strengths of these four impressions, holding them together in our thoughts as we might hold the tones of a melody, when we compare them as regards their magnitude, we get that measure of harmony which obtains between the forces of the ego, of the astral body, of the etheric body, and of the physical body. This that I have shown you is an occult sign. It is what might be called characters from the occult script. Such signs may be meditated on. I have described to you as nearly as possible the manner of such meditations. We get an impression of the varying degrees of strength which these surfaces acquire by reason of their difference in size, when we compare them equally in thought. By comparing them thus, we gain an impression of the proportion of the forces of the four principles of man, one with another. These things exist as signs of the true occult script, which is rooted in the real existence of things. To meditate on this script means to read the great symbols of the wonders of the world, and to be initiated into the mighty mysteries of the universe. In doing so, we gradually acquire a general understanding of the forces working in the cosmos as world wonders, which are caused by the outpouring of spirit into matter according to certain fixed proportions. In showing you this symbol, I have at the same time called up in your souls something which was actually one of the most elementary exercises in the ancient Pythagorean school. The first step toward perceiving, through spiritual hearing, the harmonies and melodies of the forces in the world is made by contemplating the occult signs and realizing what they are. We then know that we have beheld the world and its wonders in their reality. We shall take up this subject again in the next lecture. My aim in placing before you this symbol of the occult script was to lead you a step further in the understanding of the nature of man. The end of Lecture 3.